The lights are on red. We're away.
Hello, welcome to MotoGPOD, the internet radio show about motorcycle road racing. Today is November 13th, Friday the 13th, and this is episode 203. My name is Jules Cisek. I'm here with Jim Race. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Jules. How's it going?
We've arrived at that place that we've been dreading.
I know. Hell.
Yeah. all the racing's done with. In the series that we cover typically, and we've got obviously a lot to talk about this what happened this weekend, but it's the end of the 2009 season, and it's going to be a cold winter.
You know, you remember when you were a kid and you were going to school, and like, you know, you'd have summer vacation, and you know it would like kind of go on, and you know everything was happy and birds flying about and everything, you know, butterflies fluttering about. And then, you know, it was done. And you're like, oh, God, I got to go do regular stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, butterflies. Yeah.
It's a metaphor. You know, maybe a metaphor for some of Lorenzo's launches last year. But, yeah, I mean, we still had, I think we had a fantastic end of the season. We'll talk about that shortly. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, we've got, you know, the other part of the downside of it, I think, Jules, is that we don't have all the testing that we normally have to look forward to.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. It used to be that, you know, we'd be relatively jam-packed, not only with GP, but World Superbike as well, and, you know, other things going on. And we certainly had a pretty neat post-race test this week, but it's well, we knew it.
Yep.
It always happens, you know. It's like, oh, son of a bitch. let's pop along here and see if we can't inject some enthusiasm into this and keep not only ourselves but our listeners entertained
and awake
and awake. Yeah. Don't listen to this anytime past 11 p.m. at night. we got a few emails this week, and thank you everybody for writing in, and hopefully we wrote back to all of you. I just pointed one out, which kind of made me chuckle, which was from Tony Pags, and thank you, Tony, for writing in. The subject, I think he sent it to you, and he forwarded it to me. It's just, yeah. Congrats to Jim Race, and I'm like, huh, you know, you see a subject like that, you're like, uh-oh. But, in the email, he wrote, for predicting the Spies spoiler, the kid is already contributing to the team, consciously or otherwise. And thank you for that. I kind of, you know, you could have kind of predicted that a little bit early, but it was very surprising that Spies ran as well as he did in the race. And we'll detail what that spoiler was shortly. Mm-hmm. It was a little bit of a surprise to everybody, I think. It was fun. You know, there wasn't a whole lot to decide except for the 250 race, which was mind-blowing.
Right. This is bizarreness.
Well, you and I spent...
Before we move on off the Spies thing, I did want to mention Robert Bullock wrote in saying that, you know, I made a statement that even Spies fans were surprised at the success in World Superbikes, and he basically was like, I wasn't. So he's a big Spies fan. He wrote a very nice email. I'm not going to get into it, but, you know, he makes a good point that, you know, it's been coming. This Ben Spies coming has been coming.
Yeah, the coming of Spies. Nobody take that wrong, please. I think there's a lot of people that are pragmatists about the whole thing and don't want to
too much expectations, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the part of the point is that if, you know, if everybody's expecting him to do this absolutely stellar job and, you know, become one of the aliens, as it were, and end up on the podium every weekend, he doesn't want that either. And he's been very clear about that when we're talking about GP. But World Superbike, even from the beginning, he said he thought that was going to be hard, and he clearly conquered that early and often. What he'll do in GP, who knows? But he had a promising start, and yeah, we'll get into that shortly.
So you want to do let's do 125s MotoGP, okay, and then to 250s, because the 250s were the star of the weekend.
Absolutely, absolutely. 125s. No kind of real surprise at the front.
Well, except for the fact that these Simone and Smith have been going at it for now. This is three rounds in a row where they were just them. It was just all about them. So yeah, they cranked it up. Aspar really cranked it up.
Yep, and in fact, this race was, if you think about it, fairly similar in some ways to Phillip Island, where Simone was titled. And definitely a great battle with those two. They got away. Well, Smith streaked out to a huge lead right at the beginning. Let's take one step back. I always say that, don't I? Bradley Smith had a problem on his warm-up lap where his bike stalled, right? So he's on pole. Either pole or second. No, maybe second. So he stalls, and everybody else is gridded up, and he's still half a lap back, and they're sitting there, and two strokes don't like to sit on the starting line. Now, granted, it was a little bit chilly there in Valencia, but don't like to sit on the starting line for long periods of time. And he finally rolled up, and it was clear that he was, like, peeved and anxious and kind of probably freaking out just a little bit, and then got the start of his life, and jumped out to what, a 4 or 5 second lead or 3 or 4 second lead right off the bat.
Yeah. 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 And, you know, typical of Simone, he's been in the past, he's been a very headstrong racer. He's become very patient. I think that's one of the reasons why he took the championship is he's a very patient racer. He can see that his pace is good and that he is gaining on Smith. And a lot of times, you know, these kids will tend to, well, he's not a kid. I'm just saying, like the 125 racers will tend to try to get everything done in one lap, you know?
Right.
And,
right,
you know, like people like Iannone, he's a classic example of somebody who will try to get everything done in one lap. He's not very patient.
Yeah.
So the fact that Smith was way ahead didn't deter Simone from just cranking out those laps, lap after lap, and eventually, catching Smith. And I have to say, like, I was really just bummed watching because Smith ran a great race. Simone ran a perfect race. I don't think he made a single mistake. And Smith basically made one mistake, and that's what cost him the race.
Right. You know? Well, which is almost exactly what happened at PI.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. Exactly. And I was just thinking to myself, man, he must be just like, ah. Not again, because the PI race was still, the championship was still, I mean, the chances of him winning the championship were, for Smith winning the championship were low, but you never know. And he ran wide there and he ran wide here and Simone just slipped right through. And then, you know, they finished really close, but Simone did win.
Yeah. Well, the one thing that this was good for Bradley was he did cement his second place in the championship. So,
right. That's true. That's true.
And that's very important for Aspar, especially considering, you know, they're going to the GP ranks as well as, you know, sticking with 250s. Well, not 250s, Moto 2 and 125 next year. You're talking about a full service team, huh?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And they did, I mean, they did very well in the 250s as well this year.
Yeah.
They were fighting for the championship for most of the season.
Absolutely. So, yeah. 125s was fun, and it was kind of just a taste of things to come, wasn't it?
Oh yeah, yeah.
Yeah, there were big problems this weekend with Valencia wind, and especially on Sunday, the wind was just blowing straight down towards turn one.
Yep.
And I can tell you from personal experience, that's the last thing you want.
Yeah, all your braking markers are all effed up.
Yep. And on top of that, if you're drafting somebody, it's even worse because you come out of the draft and for one thing, you normally can't see your markers so well, and especially if you're relying on the person in front of you to give you some indications when to stop the bike, you've got real trouble. And that particular thing came to a head in the 250 race, didn't it?
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
We definitely want to talk about that. Yeah. And of course, 125s being incredibly light bikes, they were definitely the most affected.
Yeah. Talk about the cheese grater fairings, man. Everybody had that.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. And actually, even up through the premier class, I saw a couple of holes in the GP bikes as well. And you don't normally only see those at places like PI. So, during QP or maybe FP2, I saw some video where like the dust is just like blowing all over the place. And there's a couple of pictures from FP1 where you can see riders coming through corners. And the track was dirty as well. You know, it's getting dirt blown all over it. And frankly, it wasn't in the best shape. It was cool. Not necessarily. Well, everybody that was there said it was cold.
Right.
That was probably, a factor of wind chill. But it is going to keep the track cool. And I didn't pay a whole lot of attention, but I'm guessing that most people probably went with the softest tire they could get.
Yeah, yeah, I could see that. I could see that. I also wanted to mention that Paul Espargaro, once again, put in a really good ride. And while he didn't quite catch Nicholas Tirol in the World Championship standings, he ended up fourth. He did beat Sergio Gadea over the last, Sergio Gadea was in third for a while,
mm-hmm.
and Paul Espargaro was down in the low of, well, in the top 10, but much lower. And then, I just keep having to bring this up here. I've just been amazed ever since Indianapolis. He's just been amazing, this guy. So he had this lonely third, and the reason why I wanted to mention it was because I think one of the worst, camera director goofs was on the last lap of the 125 race where Simone and Smith were battling it out. And we were like, okay, somebody's going to make a move in turn two. And then we see Espargaro in third place all alone because he had nobody in front of him. He was way behind Simone and Smith. And the next guy back was how far back was Corsi? Like 5 seconds back behind him.
It was
hello.
Very Spanish film crew that was working there.
Yeah, but they had a Spanish guy up in front too.
Well, but that was already locked up, and you gotta also think that.
So we're watching a guy going alone, all by himself, he's not fighting with anybody. On the last lap, while there's an incredibly intense battle going up front, I'm sorry. I don't care what the sponsors say. I mean, I know you're playing devil's advocate here, but
and frankly, I'm not arguing for it. I will point out that right now, the last name of Espargaro in Spain has a fair amount of notoriety because of both the brothers. So they're probably paying an awful lot of attention. You certainly saw a whole bunch of the older brother. In GP,
yeah, plenty. Yeah, but you know what? When we were in Sepang, hardly even saw Stoner.
Oh, true.
You know? And he was in the freaking lead.
Yeah,
and this guy's in third. Well, there's a battle going on for second. So, for first. So I don't know. I thought that was really weak, very weak. And and we didn't even get to see any replays of those passes. All of a sudden, we came back and the positions were changed and. We kind of missed out, I think, on some good racing there. Anyway, that was a little personal beef.
Mini rant.
A little mini rant. Anyway, so championship, is over with 125s. I was kind of hoping that Espargaro was going to catch Tirol, but then I realized that that would have taken Tirol basically not finishing in the points, and Tirol finished, he finished 10th.
Yeah.
So Espargaro was not able to catch him for third. But still, incredible job by Paul Espargaro and Nicholas Tirol and, Bradley Smith and Julian Simon and all those guys. So,
yeah. No, I was surprised nobody got blown over because the wind was just nasty.
Yeah. I think it was picking up over the day. I think that it was one of those times where it was a really good thing that 125s got to run before, earliest.
Yeah. Well, and on top of that, it's not like, I say nobody got blown over, but, 125s, there were a whole bunch of guys out. There were 12 or 13. So,
we don't know.
yeah. who may or may, and you know, some good racers too. So, that was a fitting end to the end of the season. You're right. Yeah. And frankly, the lovely direction that you were just alluding to kind of continued on through the day, didn't it?
Yeah, it did.
Or the night. for those people out there, Jules and I are always kind of joking about IMing each other lately and staying up really late, way too late. And boy, we kept at it again this weekend, didn't
we? Oh, yeah. And I had stuff to do on Sunday, too, on top of that. All right, so then... You know, I want to save the 250s for last. Obviously, let's talk about MotoGP.
Okay.
I think, you know, because it was pretty much decided before they grid it up for the start.
Well, yes and no, because we did have a little bit of an issue on the warm up lap, didn't we?
Well, that's what I'm saying. Is it was kind of decided before
the trip. Yeah. The lights went out.
Yeah.
I want to hear your description of that. I have my own.
Well, first of all, it was kind of like a what? Like dough and a whole bunch of different emotions mixed in. So, you know, Casey Stoner was the fastest all weekend. I don't think there was any sessions where he wasn't the fastest. I think Pedrosa. No, Casey Stoner was the fastest the whole weekend. And he's been on an incredible run. Of results,
ever since his vacation,
and he was definitely looking like, I mean, I was really predicting basically that it was going to be Stoner, then 10 seconds behind him was going to be Pedrosa, then like, you know, 5 seconds behind him was like either Lorenzo or Rossi.
You were literally predicting that.
Yeah.
Yeah. As was I.
What's that?
As was I.
Yeah. And then on the warm up lap, which is so everybody's off the grid already. They're just gonna make their final and they did actually go out just like we were talking about in Sepang. Remember, they actually went out for two laps. A lot of the riders went out for two laps because of the wind. I think they wanted to really check out what the situation was like on the track. So they ended up this is on their out lap before they went on the grid.
Right.
You know, everything got set up on the grid, but then during the warm up lap, Stoner got blown over, or his tires were too cold, or whatever. But he fell, and he fell in a really, really bad place because it's about as far as you can go from pit lane, and there was no way he's going to be able to get back in time to even grab a second bike and start from the pit lane, which he could have done, I guess, right?
He could have, but it was really clear from his body position that he's like, you know,
screw it.
Yeah.
I'd rather be fishing.
Yeah. Well, trying to fish. Yeah, it was just very odd. And from the onboard stuff, you could see that he clearly high sided, which means probably cold tires. Somebody made a really funny cartoon that I saw, or a little Photoshop mock up with a cloud, an animated cloud blowing him off the bike. made me laugh just a bit, but whether the wind, the wind probably did have a part to play in that regardless, because when you have winds like that, they tend to steal the heat from the tire warmers. You know, you just can't keep those things blanketed up enough.
Yeah, not to mention the actual surface.
Yeah, but there was a really weird kind of weak excuse that I saw come out of the team, and I won't even go into it. But
no,
about,
go into it. I want to hear.
You know, I'd have to pull it up. It involves, you know, starting off on the B bike, running out there in the out lap, and then coming back in, swapping that to the A bike for the warm up lap, and he forgot to swap or some foo-fara. Like that.
Nice.
And it sounded like an excuse to me.
Why would they have started with the B bike? They were still working on the A bike or something?
No, they were doing that to save fuel.
Oh, geez. Wow. Yeah. Okay.
And apparently they call it the Ducati strategy, which,
often, I guess, involves a revolver with a bullet in it.
Well, apparently so this weekend. And so that set the whole thing up. And so this happens on the warm-up lap. So everybody comes around and are kind of looking at this big hole in pole position going, what the hell? And the lights go red and then they go out and everybody's off and, you know, everybody there is going, well, he was hauling ass all weekend, and that's a few more points that I'm going to get. So it turned into...
In fact, Pedrosa was saying he was looking over to the left and going, what?
Yeah.
And you know, everybody was kind of confused, and then the lights went on, and then, you know, they had to really rush. I think Pedrosa had his visor up when their lights went on.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Pretty wild. So, pretty weird. Because we've had this kind of a thing happen. Remember when Lorenzo crashed on one of his warm-up laps? But he was able to get his bike going again, so he was able to grid up again. He just was scuffed up.
Yeah, Mugello, I think it was.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I mean, it was a very odd thing. You know, normally if something like that happens, at least the guy will be able to, you know, pick it up and we'll see him later. But you're not used to the pole sitter doing it.
Right, you know? right.
And everybody can see that hole. And at the same time, they're all kind of waiting. So, I guess the nicest term is a bit of a gaffe there.
Mm-hmm.
In the meantime, it settled down to a kind of a workmanlike classic Valencia race in some ways.
Yeah.
There was some good battling between, you know, Pedrosa got out there and stayed out there.
Yep.
The Spaniard crowd was just loving all of that. I mean, just going nutso. And then, you know, Valle and Lorenzo kind of just, you know, played back and forth for a while until, you know, Rossi got a decent lead and just kept it there pretty much, don't you think?
Well, then Lorenzo started catching it, but he ran out of laps.
Yeah.
And I think that Rossi was probably controlling the pace at that point anyway.
Yeah, and those guys were, like, at that point had taken such an immense lead over the rest of the pack. I mean, you know, it's like, what, 30 seconds back to number four, who was Colin.
We're going
to
talk about a lot more.
Yeah. Followed by Nicky Hayden, Tony Elias, Ben Spies, Levy, Talio, DeAngelis in 10th, and the rest on the way down.
Great showing for Hayden. Great showing for Hayden.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, all those guys got a little bit gifted by Casey, so they're all kind of like, thank you.
Yeah. I mean, Colin Edwards had two gifts on Sunday, because one was definitely the fact that, you know, finishing fifth instead of sixth is 2 points.
But so, how he finished this was kind of cool.
So first, thanks to Casey Stoner, right? But then he also needed Dovizioso to finish below seventh. Exactly below seventh, because Dovizioso had win this season. So if they had tied on points, then Dovizioso would have taken that fifth spot in the championship. But hello,
I'm here.
Oh, okay, are you sitting on the edge of your seat or something, or are you just falling asleep?
I am.
Edwards' incoming teammates, Ben Spies, took Dovizioso a couple laps on the end, right?
Yeah, and frankly, his weekend was kind of fascinating in a way, because, you know, he started off on Friday, you know, kind of weak, not weak, but testing the limits of the bike. Mm-hmm. And it was clear all weekend. I'm going to talk about this in a bit about tires, because I noticed something straight off the bat on Friday with him. But he started off the weekend just kind of trying to figure things out. And he knew going in that obviously he wasn't going to win the race, and that wasn't his target. He wanted to come in and figure things out, make a decent impression. But I'm pretty sure that he didn't think that he was going to do as well as he did. But every time he got on the bike, he was faster. Every time.
Which is basically Spies
method.
Method, you know.
The Spies method.
All right.
And literally, it's very methodical. It's like, you know, make a tiny change. And according to what I've read, and this has been a very consistent tale, the only thing they did to that bike all weekend was they took it out of the box, they dropped the front end 2 millimeters, and they ran. And they didn't do it, you know, they may have moved the bars or the foot pegs around a little bit, but they in theory, said they did very little else. And I'm kind of believing that. I think he was just trying to learn the bike as it comes.
Right.
Later when he understands it. And we talked about this last week. You know, there's so much adjustability on these things. Understand it as it comes first. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Get to start with the base, learn the base, and then start veering away from it. And, exactly. And he has a great base to work from because there's been a lot of good riding on this bike, on this configuration.
No doubt. And I still don't have the full lowdown on exactly what configuration that bike is. I've heard conflicting reports that it's got some 2010 parts on it, that it's halfway between a Fiat bike and a Tech 3 bike. But whatever, clearly the bike was capable this weekend. Mm-hmm. And whatever engine they gave him was just fine. And in retrospect, you know, we were kind of wondering, you know, what kind of engine they're going to give him. And I think they just needed to give him whatever he needed to do well. You know, if they handed him some, you know, turbo nitrous oxide thing, he certainly wouldn't have been able to use it to its full capability because he wasn't used to the bike nor the tires yet.
And it's Valencia, which is where power is not going to get you that much.
Very clearly. Good job. Excellent job. Bodes really well for next year.
And at the end of the race, Colin Edwards ran over to Ben Spee's garage and gave him a big hug because you know, Colin did get his fifth place in the championship. So he's the best of the non-aliens.
Absolutely.
By 1 point.
And, I think he said something like, you know, I'll buy him anything he wants, dude. Debbie's been a little disappointing the last half of the year, hasn't he?
He has. Actually, he's been pretty much disappointing the whole year. I still think that there are some people that perform really well in the role of an underdog.
Okay.
And because they have an extra reason, they have like an extra challenge or something, and also it gives them a kind of a safety net when the results are not so good. They can always say, well, you know, I mean, I am riding on crap equipment or whatever. And the Vizioso just really strikes me like the guy. He did so much better last year when he was on a satellite team than this year. Now, granted, he had some, you know, nasty falls and stuff.
But he's also has a couple of shining moments, too.
He had a couple of shining moments. But he got one podium last year. This year he got two. And one of them was the rain race.
Consistency is not his form yet.
No, and actually he's been pretty if anything, the consistency was during those three races where he fell.
<You know? laughs> Yeah, indeed.
But you could also blame it on Honda's just been really pushing the development on the bike, but then Pedrosa finished third in the championship, also thanks to Casey Stoner's wipeout. Danny Pedrosa is third in the championship, so I guess he gets to keep his number.
Never thought of it that way, yeah. And you know, who else was a nice surprise was Callio in ninth. That's a great result for him, and frankly, with both he and Hayden showing some progress, and Espargaró in 13th, I'm feeling more upbeat about Ducatis for next year.
Yeah, well, Hayden did fantastic, obviously, so.
Yeah, don't want to discount that. Just a reminder that Debbie's kind of been on a bit of a test mule since I think it was, which track was that? Not Le Mans.
Assen.
Was it Assen?
When he got, yeah, because that's when he fell because the chassis was really stiff.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. And so he's been running the Orleans now, and, by the way, Pedrosa also ran in the test this week. So they've kind of gone full song that way. I'm not making excuses for him, and frankly, I won't, because I expected more out of him when he came to the factory team, and he's just been really inconsistent.
Yeah.
Inconsistent on the bad side.
Right, right.
Let's
talk about that mid-pack, because everything got completely turned on its head. You were kind of predicting this also just before the race, because there was so few points separating 7th through 13th.
13th to 12th. Yeah, walk me through it. I don't have it in front of me, but I know that it scrambled once again.
Yeah, totally scrambled, because we had before the weekend we had Marco Melandri in 7th. Caparossi was in 8th. De Angelis was in 9th. Elias was in 10th. Then we had Vermeulen, Depugnier, and Nicky Hayden. And now, what do we have now?
We've got Elias all the way up there.
Yeah, he picked up a bunch of points because he finished 7th.
7th or 6th, I think.
6th, yep.
Your 7th through 12th or 13th, as you said, was Elias De Angelis, Caparossi, who was, he kind of stayed in the same joint, didn't he?
Yeah.
Melandri, Depugnier, Vermeulen, who had a dismal season.
Yeah.
Shipping out. And Nicky, who picked up a little bit.
Yeah, but he didn't get to pick up a spot. I mean, and the thing is, you know, 13th is actually pretty shitty for Nicky. I don't think he's ever finished this low in the championship. But you know, he's had, what, 3 mishaps that really weren't his doing?
Right.
And on top
of that, he's moving up.
Yeah, and that's the thing I was going to say. Aside from those things, like, if you look at his results, they're going in the right direction.
Yep, and Callio in 15th, frankly, isn't truly representative of what his progress has been either. So
right, yeah, he had a couple of very disappointing last lap crashes.
Indeed,
you know, out of 6th place, and I think out of 5th once. So,
and so, who's our rider of the year that is in almost dead set mid pack still? Melandri still.
He had a terrible race, which is really sad because Valencia is one of his favorite tracks, and he's done very well here before. In fact, he took a second in the championship in 2005 when he beat Nicky Hayden there. And he just did not have a good race. But it's good to see that he still managed to keep the top 10, because he is basically on a bike that has not received that much development since testing. I think since probably like before the Jerez test.
Well, you know, I heard there were a couple of.
I'm sure they've been giving them bits as soon as his results start showing up. You know, you're not going to just sit there and just say, "Oh, well, let's see, let's just keep going."
But they're not, you know, brand new chassis, redeveloped engines, new mapping. It's just probably more you know, a replacement part that might be slightly better than the one that apparently keeps breaking all the time.
Right.
certainly, even with a bit of a dismal result last race, still getting 10th on that bike was fantastic. And, you know, now he's moving on to, and I guess my understanding, I think, you know, we were debating this a couple of episodes ago about, you know, if he was going to be number one or number two. And I think he was on the 2010 bike during testing this week. So,
yeah, but not the factory one.
Well, I think if he's on the 2010 bike, that's kind of factory.
I guess so. But, yeah, so, you know, actually, I read that he was not on the factory bike.
Was it the other Marco?
Yeah, Mark Simoncelli got the that one.
You know, we're going to do this all next year.
which Marco are you talking about?
Yeah, we're going to have to come up with, you know, 33 or T, right. as it were.
That's right.
That was a interesting end of the year race for MotoGP, and, you know, kind of a classic Valencia. You know, not going to be super exciting. Frankly, the most excitement in the entire race, I think, was on the warm-up lap.
Yeah, yeah.
Where everybody were like, "What the hell?" and there was a huge feeling too of anticipation, like, "Can he get back on?" But I mean, that was very short-lived. Everybody was already gritting up, and it was pretty much game over at that point. So, hey, it looks like you wanted to talk about the M award.
Yeah, let's talk about that after the 250s, because that's just like an interesting little tidbit. We knew this was going to be a good race, but we just didn't realize it was going to also be like totally bizarre. You know,
it was a bizarre race.
It was a totally bizarre race. I mean, so first of all, Aoyama came into this race with an interesting strategy, and he was very vocal about it. He said, basically, the safest place for me in this race is going to be at the lead.
Exactly.
Which I loved hearing. I love hearing when a racer is, you know,
just get out there and bust it.
Yeah, just bust it out.
Well, and you and I said, if you remember, we're like, okay, the alternative to that, which is what you might expect from your average Joe, is to, you know, kind of hide back and try and find yourself a cushion between, you know, spot 6 and 7 and get the points that you need to get. And as the announcers said the exact same thing, we were like, well, Clouzel's going to be back there.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many kind of scary riders.
And on top of that, we were anticipating the possibility of Simoncelli coming up and playing a little rough, right?
Yeah. But I mean, so just to recap, all Ayama had to do was finish in 11th place.
That's it.
That's all he had to do.
Yep.
So there would have been a lot of temptation to ride, you know, like you said, like 7th, 8th, something like that. Some safe position where you make a mistake, you're still fine. And you stay away Simoncelli may get rough, but he still also has to win the race for those points to matter. Because if he doesn't win the race, then Ayama doesn't even have to finish.
Well, when somebody like Hiroshi says, well, I'm going to lead this race, and somebody like Simoncelli says, well, I have to win this race.
Yeah.
That does kind of lay an interesting foundation.
Oh, yeah.
Watch.
And so, you know, it played out as, yeah, I mean, those two guys were battling against each other, and there were some gloves being, you know, tossed.
I think they were being slapped across people's faces. And on top of that,
we had Barbara in there, and we had Bautista in there, and it was just a little pack of angry dogs all just going for the win. You know, seriously, it was
great.
It was amazing. It was just how tight that front group was, and then they just kept adding to it. Clouzel was in there, and of course he fell. And
Pacini was kind of
Pacini was up. Yeah, he was catching up, and then he fell also. Yeah. But like, you know, Thomas Luthi was in there. Willeroth had an amazing race. I think he was in third at one point.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, he faded at the end, but certainly did Honda another excellent. You know, actually, frankly, he was up there creating his own little troubles for some people as the second fastest Honda.
Right.
So yeah, Clouzel out again, you know, and I posted before the beginning of this race, I'm like, Pacini has to finish this race.
Yeah.
The dude's got to finish the race, and he didn't.
Yeah.
And that was a big drag. Axel Pons was out, and Favel was out, and there was another guy that was out.
Yeah, well, we'll talk about that in a sec.
Okay, well, let's talk about then.
Let's talk about going down the straight and missing your brake marker.
Well, not like missing your brake marker, but also basically running up the rear end of, was it Barbera or Bautista?
Barbera.
Okay. And way to the outside. And remember, I mentioned the wind before, right? You've got it at your tail. You're drafting somebody. So you've got the double push down the front straight. You pop out of the bubble. You realize that you're going to run in the back of somebody else. You go wide a little bit. And Hiroshi Ayama probably
got a little surprised by that he was still going very fast.
Yeah, well, and he was probably doing about 125, 140 miles an hour across the gravel trap. And everybody held their collective breath.
Yeah.
Everybody.
At this point, Simoncelli had already taken it to the front.
Right.
The last thing we expected was Ayama to crash.
Yeah.
And here he went off at turn one, which is probably one of the most dangerous places to go off at Valencia, because you're going full speed. It's a very, 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 very big runoff. But, I mean, it's not dangerous maybe in terms of, you know, body damage, but it definitely is in terms of staying up. And it takes a long time to get back on the track if you do manage to pull it in, which he did. And he said later that he was like very thankful for all the dirt riding, which Japanese riders don't normally actually have that much dirt riding experience, but he has done a lot of off-road riding, and he said he had about a 50-50 chance of not falling.
Yeah, exactly. You know? Exactly. And it really was a heroic tour through the gravel and at very high speeds. And the thing is, he still had to make a turn.
Right.
While he's at, you know, while he's at 100 miles an hour in fairly deep gravel, and you could see the front just kept wanting to tuck, and, you know, dragging his feet, and he pulled it off, and
he got out exactly in 11th place.
Exactly.
Crazy. And, which is where he needed to be, but the worry was, of course, that you know, with all that time spent in the gravel trap, there was also kitty litter on the bike and
dust on the tires.
Yeah, dust on the tires. So it was, from that point on, you know, grit your teeth and hope for the best. And I think, I mean, we were all sitting like in total disbelief. I mean, it was like the one thing we did not expect. I mean, I think we would have been less surprised if he had crashed.
Probably.
But the fact that he came out exactly in that spot that he needed to be, and it was still a race, was just like, wow.
Right. And so he's in 11th and Simoncelli's in first,
yeah,
which means Hiroshi can't lose another spot. You know, he has to finish there. So if there's any damage or bother to the bike, then this is going to be a real nail biter. And, you know, Ayama started moving back up through the field in a very methodical way. Right.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Picking one guy at a time real slowly.
Well, he came out in front of Baldolini, who had a much slower pace. And so he opened up a pretty good distance between himself and Baldolini within about a lap or two.
Yeah.
But also he was pretty far behind the guy in front of him, who was it Kyle Abraham? Or was there somebody else that fell? No, it was Abraham at that point.
I think so,
was in front of him. Yep. So... That looked a little daunting to catch him. So he basically was kind of stuck in this 11th spot, and it was all up to, you know, can he keep this spot? Can he keep the motor running? And, you know, will Simoncelli win the race? And, of course, Simoncelli was having his own problems because, you know, Barbera and Bautista were definitely in front of the Spanish crowd. They were not going to let Simoncelli just win this one.
On top of that, you know, Barbera has much love for Marco.
Yeah.
Yeah, he would have been happy to play spoiler in that case.
Yep, yep. In a way, he kind of did, I guess, because he pushed him. He pushed him really hard.
How hard, Jules?
He pushed him hard enough that Simoncelli, you know, had a bit of a moment and didn't recover, and then about maybe 50 feet later fell.
I think that's a tidy wrap up there.
Yeah.
Another one of the holy crap moments in this race.
Yeah.
And a bit of a shocker, but that was like done and dusted, you know, wipe your hands off, game over. Cause the bike was done and it was clear that he was done. He wasn't hurt.
Yeah. And he basically Simoncelli fell out of the lead. You know, he wasn't going to win this race. I mean, he was going to win this race, but he wasn't going to win the championship, but that it still had to hurt.
You know, the crash that he did there was looked kind of similar in execution, if you will, to the crash that happened to, because he was a bit offline,
mm-hmm.
To, I forget where it was, excuse me, but the crash that Lorenzo had when he was battling back and forth with Rossi, and he got a little bit outside.
In Brno. Yeah. A little bit different because what happened here, I think, is Simoncelli hit the white line coming off of...
which upset the bike.
Yeah,
right?
It upset the bike, and he never really regained control of it. I think he almost felt like he was going to be able to ride it out. And so he turned it in very sharply, and that's when he lost the front. I think the bike was still very unsettled. The suspension was probably, like, goofy, you know?
Yeah, you're probably right. You're probably very right on that. But yeah, I mean, that was like, okay, game, set, and match. And
so then, you know, obviously Ayama, ended up finishing seventh because a bunch of guys retired in front of him.
Absolutely.
There were a couple of times in there where I was thinking, you know, just stop, start celebrating because it was such a, I mean, if it was me in that position, I probably would be like, you know, you know, I need a freaking drink. You know, I mean that moment when he came off turn one, came off of turn one. I mean that would have eaten up all kind of energy, motivation, whatever. So it was cool that he actually, you know, he kept picking up the pace.
He did. I mean, maybe he wanted to finish in front of his brother.
Yeah.
Which he did.
His brother
ended up finishing 11th too.
Yeah.
Which is where Hiroshi originally came back on. You know, I think part of it also, Jules, is that he's clearly thinking about next season as well.
Of course.
And the deal that's going on with Scott now, and we'll chat about that in a bit, and what he's, you know, what he's jockeying for next year, and it looks like that's mostly worked out. What are you going to do? I mean, and the guy's still a racer. You know?
Yeah. No, I don't doubt why there are certain points where you just say like, I'm just going to stop right now. And I mean, I won the championship and yeah. Whew. Wild. I think that the biggest surprise that we didn't really anticipate, we didn't talk about, was that by crashing Simoncelli and Barbara finishing the race in first, winning the race, he actually ended up in second place.
Yep.
Where he wasn't really vying for the championship lead since like round two or three.
Right.
You know?
Certainly not something anybody expected. And
especially with Bautista and Simoncelli and Ayama like locked with a few points. I mean, well, sorry, it was really just Bautista and Ayama for most of the season. And then Simoncelli suddenly came just flying back, you know, with a series of wins. But Barbara just was extremely consistent this year. And, you know, I think Sito kind of had him sat him down and was like, you know, just chill, and yeah. And I bet you'll do better.
don't do a Bautista this year, and you know, save some of the equipment because we're going to try and resell this to some CTV. it was a fitting end, and nice to have a Valencia race that had some surprises, right?
And you know what we forgot to mention in the 250 race is that the pole sitter, the guy who got the pole, didn't get to race either. Because the pole was actually Alex de Bones, but he had crashed at the very end of the qualifying session, and it was a bad crash.
Turn one,
and he got fairly hurt, and he just was not able to race. He tried, actually, I believe in warm up, he went out.
He did run a warm up. They said it was rather heroic and painful looking.
Yeah. So they actually were, because he didn't ever show up on the grid. They did reshuffle the grid, but
exactly.
And Simoncelli basically inherited that spot.
Fat letter good it did him.
Yeah.
It was an exciting end of the season. And cheers to the new 250 champion. Cheers to everybody else that made it a fun battle throughout the season. And
there's a lot of Japanese fans out there who finally have a Japanese champion. It's the first Japanese champion in the World Series since 2001.
Which was Kato.
Which was Kato, yep.
Well, and on top of that, you know, good for Honda for nailing down the final 250 GP championship, and especially a bit of a feather in the cap, if you will, since they're going to be supplying motors next year.
Right.
And they can use that as a stepping stone, but as maybe a point of pride, right?
Definitely. It'll be in the history books as, you know, last champion was riding a Honda.
Yep.
Last champion of the 990s rode a Honda.
Indeed. You know. And DeRosa on the box again.
That's right.
Nice little surprise. So, and he just got signed to yet another one of our Moto2 signings. So our Moto2 show is looking like it's going to come together, folks. Pretty cool because a lot happened.
Yeah. There was a lot of slots being closed.
It was all about, everything kind of gelled a bit, and it's still happening at this very moment. And, but we're really putting things together. If you want to kind of get caught up, you can look on Ride On 2. We're not going to spill all the beans right now because all the beans aren't ready to be spilled for one thing. And I think we're going to have a fantastic Moto2 show when we nail one and put it together.
Cool. So yeah, I did want to talk about this BMW M Award because I was just thinking about like, well, some of these guys must have a bunch of these BMWs, and I wonder what they do with them. That's kind of how this all started. I mean, there's one award which is during the IRTA test,
mm-hmm.
the final IRTA test. There's basically like a qualifying session, and the person who wins that wins an award.
Yeah, right, that would be known as Race Zero, or it would have been known as Race Zero.
Right. But those aren't as interesting to me because they have basically zero to do with the championship.
Yep.
The actual BMW M Award is given to the rider who has the best qualifying. So they basically classify the qualifying over the last 2 years, in 2008, 2009. They used the scoring system that they would use for wins for, and they basically gave those to the qualifying positions that you finished in. And in previous years, from 2003 when they first started doing this, 2007, it was basically aggregate times from all the qualifying sessions, yeah. Which actually I thought was a cool way of doing it.
I kind of like that too, but you know, there can be weird stuff that happens there.
I think they figured out that there was like there may have been some weird ways to game it or something when you're on a short track, you know, do ride differently than when you're on a long track, all that kind of crap.
There were times of giving Rossi BMWs.
Well, that's the thing is like when I looked at these, it turns out there's been a lot of winners and there's some very surprising results.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll just go through them from the beginning. Actually, let's go backwards because it'll be more interesting. So this year Rossi had the best qualifying, which is kind of interesting because we've seen Lorenzo and we've seen Stoner and Pedrosa all do very well in qualifying. I think Stoner obviously got hurt by missing the three rounds. So this year it ended up being with Rossi and Lorenzo and then Pedrosa and Stoner. So not a big surprise because it's the aliens and Stoner, you know, maybe may have been fourth, but that's because he missed the three rounds. 2008, not a surprise. Stoner, he had a huge run of poles. But then it was Rossi, Pedrosa, Lorenzo, which I found kind of strange because I thought Lorenzo had an incredible, you know, pole setting, you know, festival. But then when I looked at it, I realized that it started that way, but then he had all those crazy crashes and he was, he had a couple of really bad results. You know, we go back to 2007, and this is now on aggregate qualification times. This was Stoner's year and, Stoner, definitely had that one wrapped up pretty early. Actually, he won by a big margin over Rossi, then Pedrosa, and then Depunier was the fourth guy. And you know, we've forgotten this, but Depunier for a long time has been a really fantastic qualifying guy, especially when they had true qualifying tires.
Yeah, it's the whole finishing aspect was difficult.
Exactly. 2006, this was a huge surprise when I looked at this thing. It was Hayden who won the qualifiers, and then Edwards in uh-huh. second, Nakano in third, and only then Rossi. Now, obviously, Hayden won the championship, but he only won it by a few points, and it was a very close battle between those two. And it just really reminded me, yeah, that's right. Rossi was really not that big on qualifying positions because he always was able to kind of recover very early in the race.
No, it was 06 pretty much sucked for him across the map.
Well, it also sucked for him. But even in 2007, like that, he wasn't shooting for those as much as he started to after losing
right.
to Stoner and realizing that he had to be up front, especially last year. Last year was a big year where that really paid off for him, all that work, because he was never really a good starter. And this year he was great.
Mm-hmm.
Then we go back to 2005. Which was the year that Rossi just completely ran away with the championship, but he didn't win the BMW. It was Gibernau. So it was Gibernau, Rossi, and then Hayden again, and then Melandri, which I also found interesting because I never really remembered Hayden as being a good qualifier, but I guess he was. I just, you know, it just starts to fade from memory. 2004, it was Rossi's year with Yamaha, and first year with Yamaha, and he did actually beat out Gibernau by just I think about 3 seconds on the aggregate qual times, which is pretty close. So it was Rossi, Gibernau, Biaggi, and Barros. And then 2003, you know, that was the kind of like the easy year for Rossi. On the Honda, it was Rossi, Biaggi, Caparossi, and Gibernau. Anyway, I just looked at those, and it kind of just it brought back some memories of all those seasons. And once you combine these along with the IRTA test, what the hell do they do with these cars? You know, do they give them away for charity or something? I mean,
I get some extended families, Jules.
That's true. Yeah, there's a lot of happy Rossies riding around in BMW whatevers.
Or sell it for tax money.
Oh man. Or to pay their accountant. Okay.
You hand it off to the local maid man. Anyway, I could probably head way down that road and get in all sorts of trouble.
Yeah.
But it was a fun weekend. Had a good time. Still whooped from it. You know, I'm kind of bummed that the season's over, but I could use a little rest, Jules.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess our weekend's going to be sleep-ins for once.
Pretty much. But, you know, we weren't done yet, were we?
No. This was actually the most interesting part of Valencia came after, I think.
It did, and I wasn't sure last week when we did the cast, and because I thought Monday might be a journal day, but it wasn't. We had full 3 days of testing.
Mm-hmm.
And we had some surprises. One of the big surprises, at least for me, because it didn't even figure into my reckoning. Because you get kind of focused on MotoGP and used to everything kind of being the same. And then this was the first time we had Moto2 bikes out, which is pretty damn cool.
Well, we've had them out before for like parts of not even exhibitions. They've raced in certain series, but
yeah, but they ain't been out on the same track on the same day with a MotoGP bike. That's for sure.
And specifically with the riders that we actually have been following. So
yeah, not all of them. Some of them. We had some of the 250 guys. We had some GP guys. We're moving down. But yeah, it was very cool. But I mean, the top of the charts were in the end. You know, at least the front four are aliens.
Yep.
Still alien.
but not by much.
Not much, and we had some real surprises. Like on day two, day three, we also had once again somebody that's looking rather shy. You know, and it's still early days, right? This is the first test of the year in theory, and not everybody's got all their 2010 bits. Some just have minor revisions, especially Suzuki as an example. We've got like a new exhaust and a new fairing, and that's it so far.
Mm-hmm.
And that could account for their results, but then all of us, you know, really wanted Suzuki to step up. But they say February when they get their major revisions. But your top four in testing: Stoner, Lorenzo, Pedrosa, Rossi. Whoa, big surprise! No,
yeah.
but then your next five was very cool. Hayden Duffy. Hey, maybe. Well, that was just testing, so he doesn't actually have to fight with anybody. Marco Melandri on the Grassini bike. Yay, in seventh. Welcome home. Maybe he could have done that on the Hayate. And he was doing it in testing last year, right?
Yep.
Ben Spies, well done. Eighth place. Mika Kallio, ninth on the Duck. I don't think anybody had a GP10 yet, did they?
No.
So just some revisions. 10th, Depunier. I'm never going to call him Mr. Consistent, but well played.
Mm-hmm.
Loris Caparossi in 11th. And this is where the times start to stretch out a little bit. Espargaro, pretty well done. Still, you know, within a shout. He's, a second and a 1.3 off the top guys. And then we slide down. Barbera. Understandable on the Ducati, and that's the S-Bar one, right?
Yep, Yep. I thought that was quite cool.
That is good. And then that's Gibernau's old bike. It's probably just been sitting in a dusty shed somewhere.
Yeah, just new stickers.
Colin, who only got one day in because apparently...
Well, you missed Simoncelli, but...
Sorry.
Yeah, yep. Simoncelli's in there.
Simoncelli in 14th.
Who had a lot to say about just like how exhilarating the motor is on these bikes.
Yeah. No, he was quite vocal, but his results didn't quite... Put it this way. He wasn't the fastest new guy.
Right. And
we were kind of expecting that he would be.
One of them, yeah.
One of them. He's there, but Colin Edwards only had one day on the bike. He got sick. Who knows what that was from? You know how Colin is.
100 beers, dude. 100 beers.
Indeed. Bautista on the Suzuki number 19, lovingly clad in black carbon fiber. Always love to see that at the test.
Right.
At the first test, you get kind of sick of it after a while, but it really is fun to look at for a bit. And moving it on down further, we had Hiroshi Aoyama, and this is kind of weird. So he was on a MotoGP bike, the old Scott bike, the one that Tamashii was riding.
Mm-hmm.
But Scott Honda, their MotoGP effort, and he rode it all the way through day three.
Yeah,
today.
Yep.
Is dead. It's done and dusted.
Right, that's right.
And so, I was kind of trying to figure out why he was riding that. Unless that is the bike that's going to Daniel Eppen's squad for Cafe Latte. Do you know?
I don't know. I've kind of poked around on the news today. I didn't see any more explanation about it. I know that Aoyama had a lot to say about the bike.
Yeah.
He said that he had a really tough time getting used to the brakes, which are, full carbon brakes.
Right.
But nothing about the actual colors of the bike and who does it belong to or anything like that. So it was very strange.
Yeah, and so we had a pair of number fours out there, which was really weird.
Well, actually, he was like a 400, wasn't he?
Oh, but when you look at the photos, it was just a four.
Yeah, okay.
So we had him and W both running around number. I mean, obviously, you're not going to get them mixed up or confused or anything, but it was a little bit amusing.
Yeah.
After that.
Well, I guess Dovey's going to have to change his number now.
You think?
The six.
you don't have to
change. No, you don't. I know, of course not. I think only the top three are required to be given up.
If somebody wants it.
Yeah.
So our first Moto2 bike up on the grid was Tony Elias on the Grassini bike. And let me see... chassis was he running? I'm a little bit curious about that. Blend in with me. Moriwaki. So, and there's a whole bunch of the Moriwaki bikes that are out there. Now, understand that a lot of the guys have stock CBR 600 engines in there, 600 RR engines in there. And apparently some of them are running those same engines with the HRC kit and ECU to try and get as close to the real thing as they're going to end up with. And this is a real drag. I want to point this out. Originally, Honda said that the engines were going to be available for teams testing in November, right? Well, it's November now. And they're not. They're not going to be ready until late.
That's right. That's right. They said that they gave them a slab of
they gave them cases.
They gave them cases that were actually filled so that the weight was correct. Or correct this, and they were supposed to deliver actual working motors. That's right. You're right.
And the teams were supposed to have them by now, and they don't. And they're not going to be ready until late February or early March. So what does that cause for the teams? Well, first off, they have to buy CBR 600 RR engines, right, to do their testing with. On top of that, they can't do their real chassis testing. They can maybe get closer if they buy the massively expensive HRC kit.
Mm.
This is supposed to be, the class is supposed to hang things down. Well, there's no such thing as cheap racing. I think we all know that. And there are a whole bunch of, it's kind of cool. I'm sitting here looking at this and there's a ton of different marks that are going to be on the grid. And I mean, marks as far as chassis go, and it's going to be neat next year. It's going to be really cool. And again, the grid's filling up quite well. But you know, we're making them spend more money, and the racing starts in March, right?
It starts in April.
Okay, in April. Well, okay, you get your motors in March.
Yeah,
it's kind of messed up.
Yeah, yeah, that's kind of a F up.
Yeah, and you know whose fault is that? Well, I don't know. You got to say Honda, right?
And of course, there's going to be, I'm sure, tons of conspiracy spins about that, because Honda does have some bikes in there themselves. So
indeed, so you know, they'll be close, but there's going to be people who are going to be pissed off.
Yeah.
They didn't have the whole package, and you know, nobody's on top of that. Nobody's got these ECUs yet and knows what the capabilities truly are of them, you know, cause these are spec ECUs, but they've got adjustability. You need time to dial that crap in. Bummer.
Indeed. Yeah. It's a bummer.
I'll leave it at that, because I could probably rant for a while on it. I'll save that up for the Moto 2 show.
Yeah, the famed Moto 2 show.
It's going to happen, people.
Oh yeah, it's coming.
No doubt. Testing was pretty. So I mentioned Tony Elias, Kenny Noyes, one of our Americans, our Americans in Moto 2 with Promo Racing, followed by Joan Olivier, also with Promo Racing, Rath Park Willerat, who only did, I think, 1 or 2 days there on the Stop and Go Moto 2 bike. So there weren't a whole lot of Moto 2 guys out there. But
you know, what was really sad is something we didn't get a chance to mention last week, because it came out in the news just after, is that the Team KR pulled out.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, okay, so here was the deal. You know, there's base capitalization for a team, right? So you look and you go, okay, I need N number of mega dollars, or in this case, you know, kilo dollars to run a team. But they did have a hard deadline where they had to put a very relatively simple 25K euro down, which was a couple of Fridays ago, to, you know, truly have your name in the hat. And that was when it didn't happen. There were one or two other teams also that didn't quite make the mix. It's a drag, and I don't think that means that they can't get in. I think it just means that they're not in right now.
Oh, okay. So there's still a chance that they can come back if they decide to run a chassis.
I'm going to guess yes, because I don't think they're going to turn anybody away.
Well, they do have a pretty full grid.
Well, it's, you know, it's not, it's no,
it's never enough. Yeah.
The more people, the better. But you know, the question is, can the promoter race or promoter market support? And that's clearly the key right now. And you know what? You know, I look at the roster of teams that we have right now, and I'll bet some of those don't make it to the grid come April.
That's true. That's true. Yep.
I think we're going to have a lot of changes come next April, and some may be for the better, all depending upon what happens, and some may not be.
I kind of, like, since we're talking about Moto 2, let's talk about this. You know, this formula has gotten so much buzz that I think that's part of the effect that's had on this other incredible piece of news, which is the, you know, was it 2012 changed back to 1,000cc MotoGP bikes?
Well, you do see my note there, right?
It's just a proposal, I understand.
but this has been talked about for a while, Jules.
Oh, I know. I mean, of course. It's not like it's a big surprise. I'm just saying
if it happens, it will be quite interesting to see how it works and how it goes down, and if it manages to stay outside of the legal purview of the guys on the other side of the world championships.
Right.
Yeah. Who knows?
I mean, you know, I could see it going basically back to 990cc's, or I don't necessarily think that they're talking already about a spec motor, are they?
Well, no, they're saying based on production motors.
Oh man, that's crazy.
Yeah. So, which is the slippery slope language. But on the other hand, Moto 2 is based on production motors. You know, it's a different motor, but it is based on it, and it's, you know, going to be like get a little good loving, but you know, we'll have to see. You know, a lot of this is a bit of a knee-jerkish reaction to the economy and to just the base costs that a lot of teams have to put together. But again, there's no way to do this stuff cheaply at the world level. It can't happen. So, you know, maybe there's another model that will work.
Well, I have to also think that the part of it is just that the 800 is a very strange bike. It doesn't really fit into the real world kind of thing, which is the whole reason why we went to four strokes in the first place, was, you know, to bring this very exotic series more in line with what people are used to.
I'm going to point something out to you, Jules.
What?
I think you're wandering down the slippery slope that you were proclaiming before. Is okay, now we've got spec tires.
But I'm not talking about spec. I mean, the 990 era had an incredible variety of manufacturers.
It did have a great diversity, but if we start, I think you see my point. If we start moving things more towards a production based area, you know, we eventually swallowed the single tire rule, right?
Yeah. But my issue with the single tire rule was that a manufacturer got to control, got a contract. I mean, the spec, as long as it's being manufactured by more than one manufacturer, then I'm totally fine with the spec being almost exactly what I have in my motorcycle that I can buy in the store. You know.
You're really going to hate me for what I'm about to say.
Okay, tell me.
We've also come to terms with Moto 2, which has a spec engine by one manufacturer and spec tires.
Well, we've come to terms, sort of, I guess. I mean, we'll see how the series works out. And as long as we have MotoGP, then I'm fine with Moto 2 being that way. But I wouldn't want all the series to be that way. I'm just talking about the fact that the 800s are weird bikes.
No doubt.
Weird bikes. They don't. You know, when we went from the 500s to the 990s, the manufacturers basically wanted to be able to use the same manufacturing processes. They wanted to be able to appeal to a larger audience, all that kind of stuff. The 800s kind of went away from that point of.
Well, yeah, there's nobody that makes a sporting 800. Nobody that makes a race replica 800. Because all those VFR people out there are going, hey!
Yeah. And I guess there's a bunch of 796s here and there and whatever.
You know, I'm just, again, a little bit of devil's advocate. You know, just careful what you wish for. The 800s, the biggest theory about coming up with them in the first place was to slow things down, and that just didn't work.
That totally didn't work. And I think my point is that if we went back to a formula that was closer to production, that we'd actually have more manufacturers, which would take us away from this specter of a spec.
Well, and we might, but then we'd be back to a couple of different things, which would force. Okay, so if they thought the 990s were too fast and we went to 800s, right? If we decide to go back to 1000s or 990s, we return to the issue of the motors being too powerful. So what are they going to do then to curb that additional power on tracks that don't have the capability of providing the safety at the speeds that they're concerned about?
Get more electronics.
Or much less, right? Which some people would love to have, seeing those sliding, whatever. Or do they dumb down the tires further?
No. I know where you're heading. I totally agree. And I actually think that there is no going back in terms of like electronics. Like, that's a total pipe dream. That anybody who thinks that if we bring up the power on these bikes, that the electronics are going away, These things have been developed, and they're going to continue having the, you know, massive amounts of electronics, traction control, that kind of stuff. That stuff is not going to go away unless it's actually ruled out by the. It's not going to go away naturally.
Okay, well let's just save this conversation in the back of our minds for when this becomes closer.
Okay, like 2 years from now?
Yeah. Well, yeah, it could, because I do see a potential dark lining on a silver cloud. And so
nice.
I don't want to get, you know, it's an interesting idea, but it's so far away, you know, dude. You know,
yeah, I know. I mean, by that time, we're going to be old men, and you know.
Well, no, not even that. You know,
Rossi will be racing on a Suzuki, and you know.
They're going to be running, you know, triples and you know diesels at that point. Who knows? That's, it's 2012. Yeah. It's forever.
Yeah.
things just change way too fast.
Right. Let's wrap up a couple of other stories because we actually forgot to mention last week in World Superbikes. We forgot to mention that. Shinya Nakano retired.
Indeed.
And he really always was one of my favorite racers in the GPs. He had a terrible, I think, time in Superbikes, and he had a good ride this year, but still did not really have a good year. He had a couple of injuries and
his results have been just kind of, you know, winding down.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, and you know, there's a certain logic to retiring before you have to retire.
Yes. Yeah. Like you mean being full of metal?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Setting off airport detectors all the time. So, and the guy's had some pretty epic falls. I mean, hello. Yeah. So, best to you, Super Shinya, and thanks for memories, man.
All right. What else you got?
There's a quote from an interview that Chris Johnham did at Road Racer X that I thought was kind of cool with Ben Spies. Just talking about it. Let me just rip through this because this is what I was talking about last week and also talking about it right on too. And I'll just take the very specific part out. He's talking about tires and very specifically as he was working his way through the weekend, he says, I think I just need to develop that trust. There were a couple of corners I went into where I thought there was no way I would come out on the front tire and I came out just fine. That's going to be the key to him moving forward, is developing trust with the machine. And you could definitely see, and I did that one, you know, three-shot comparative thing of him. I don't know if you saw that.
Mm-hmm.
It was he, Colin, and Rossi all in the same corner, nearly the same minute. And you could see that he had a whole bunch of extra weight over the front of the bike. And that comes from not really trusting the front. A little bit worried it's going to skid out. And so we'll see how that goes. We'll see how.
Isn't that actually his style, though? Like, that's how he controls that front.
You're right. He absolutely he's a front rider, but he doesn't trust it enough yet to get into a corner hot and believe. You know, rider confidence is everything. I mean, if you don't have it, 100%, whatever percentage confidence you have is what you're going to ride the bike at. Period. That's just how it works. Yeah, I thought that was kind of cool. Just a brief note on testing, because we've been talking about this over and over again, that it's like been gutted this year. There's a total for regular MotoGP riders of 6 days left between now and next year. That's kind of shocking, isn't it?
It is.
And the next test isn't until February. Well, yeah, enjoy your guys' winter vacation, but then they go to Sepang.
Right.
Yeah, we're going to go to the Alps, and then we'll go to Sepang. and on top of that, then they go to Qatar, right?
Yeah.
So 6 days. Difference being is that the Moto2 riders are not under testing restrictions, so they'll be riding like madmen. On top of that, I think there's some provisions to let the new MotoGP rookies, because they're being forced. I think it was like a concession because they're being forced to run on these satellite teams to give them a little testing thing. Because I know Bautista, I think, is testing an Estoril next week with Nobuatsu Aoki. So we'll see how that goes. You know, Jules, there's a ton of testing going off, you know, outside of the purview, not necessarily with the factory, right, or the team riders, but, you know, these companies are testing like madmen at their, you know, their own test tracks.
Absolutely, absolutely.
It doesn't really cut it down that much, except for you're not shipping a bunch of people and cargo around. And lastly, news outside of MotoGP and World Superbike.
There is.
I know. Amazing. Shocking. Neil Hodgson, who has ridden, obviously, in both MotoGP and World. World Superbike. So I guess
some American series
is going back to BSB next year for a good team, Motorpoint Yamaha. And sounds like he's full of spit and vinegar or salt and vinegar. Ha! There's a bad pun. And so good for him. Good for him, and best of luck over there next year, you know, especially with the uncertainty going on in American road racing right now. Great way to grab a ride. And I think, you know, I think we might see a few other American racing guys end up in other series next year.
Cool. Cool.
It's kind of a funny transition.
Yeah, I like it. You know, last week while we were talking, we were on the Wednesday, we were recording the call. And then the story about Supo and Tardazzi came out, and I kind of squeezed in like this.
Your 4 a.m. addendum?
Yeah. And I hope we don't have to do it this week, but because that's really, really tricky.
Dude, the season's over.
Yeah. But I did want to wrap up on that because I didn't really mention the Tardazzi part, which is that, you know, he's retiring from World Superbikes and he basically cites, you know, lack of motivation. And there's a really good interview with him on Soup. He's a very interesting... obviously, his English is a little bit weaker than some of the people that we're used to because the grammar is very all over the place. But it's a very interesting interview because I can't tell whether he is doing a press release or he's really speaking his heart. Because, you know, part of it sounds very... heartfelt. You know, he says he lost motivation for the sport and that it's not fair for him to stay in there and you know, take up that spot where somebody else might do a much better job if they are more motivated. But a part of me is like thinking, you know, I mean, there has to be somebody, sponsors or, you know, higher up in the management at Ducati that is a little bit upset about Haga losing the championship by 6 points when there was some control that Tardazzi did have. And we've talked a lot about the fact that the riders were completely, like, you know, Haga was like, you know, I don't want to win because Fabrizio hands me a race or two.
Right.
But, you know, but you still have to kind of question the manager. And... you know, maybe the manager did actually ask Fabrizio to let Haga go past at the Mola. Who knows?
The last truly public and out loud, honest sounding departure from Ducati that I can remember, where everything was really out in the open and you knew exactly what was happening.
Yeah.
Was when Fogarty left. They're really secretive.
Kind of nice. Yeah, but you know, I don't think Foggy has ever kept the secret.
No.
His feelings. You know, he just basically shouted them out.
Exactly. but, you know, we've seen kind of some oddball things, you know, just some quiet departures, you know.
Yeah, but he's one of the so Supo is going over to HRC. Which is just weird, but on the outside it's weird, but it starts to make sense kind of. Whereas Tardazzi, I don't know, there's something about him. I just really just have a soft spot in my heart for him, you know. I feel like he's maybe getting pushed out, and he's just making a soft landing.
Well, they may be trying to do, you know, wholesale management chain. They trying to think if they had a management restructuring anytime. Well, you know, that I don't even want to speculate on that, frankly. Whatever they need to do is fine. It is just it was a big bit of a surprise. And
yeah, but I love what he said, which is that he in his mind, like, the final results are the reality.
Right.
And that Ben Spies fully deserved to win the championship. And, you know, all this talk about team orders and stuff is silly because Ben Spies won the championship.
Yep.
You know, and I think that's a great attitude. And I'm sorry, I'm just sorry to see him go.
Rivadarci as well.
Yeah.
Wow, looking through.
I wanted to just throw this one last little thing out from an email that David Emmett and I had a little exchange when I don't remember exactly what spurred it on, but that's right. So Rossi's put an ultimatum to Yamaha.
Oh well, yes and no.
Yes and no. I know. I realize it's kind of like strange context.
And on top of that, he like hysterically backpedaled today too. So
right. But basically, he was talking to the BBC at Valencia just before the race, and he said that he's giving an ultimatum to Yamaha that Yamaha needs to make a choice between him and Lorenzo next season for 2011. Otherwise he's going to go to Ducati. And David and Emmett and I had this little email exchange, and it was very funny because David was basically like, well, here's what's going to happen. Rossi will stay at Yamaha because there's no Yamaha's going to get rid of him. Lorenzo's going to go to Ducati because he already had an offer from them, and Stoner's not going to stay there, and he's going to go to Honda.
Yeah, well, I mean, okay, on top of that, though, so, well, I think a big part of it was he was probably trying to, he always talks with a lot of bluster when he talks to Susie Perry, always, just what he does, and that's who the interview was with. But on top of that, as I said, he just massively backpedaled today. You know, it was a very clear interview. The things that he was saying, you could tell that he was saying them in the context of the questions that she was asking. And then today he was like, oh, well, they took all those answers out of context. And I'm like, you know,
ultimate, you said the word ultimatum. You said the word they had to choose between me and Lorenzo.
Exactly. So, yeah, who knows? Leffenbluster, last race of the year, you know, are trying to, you know, create a more exciting off season perchance. Maybe.
I just love the fact that just the previous week, Lorenzo said that he would like to finish his career with Yamaha.
Well, okay. So maybe here's what it is.
I love that. Yeah, but the kid's 22 and he's going to be finish his career with Yamaha.
Rossi is one always want to get the last word in, right?
That's right. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And there's only one time you can do that, the last race of the year.
That's right.
And so maybe that was the attempt to, you know, create and set the stage for the off season.
I like that. That's perfect.
And that's probably a decent ending note, isn't it, Jules?
It is. It is, because we've been going for a while. So great. We will, we've got a good show coming up for you next week, and, we'll try to get that Moto2 show going before the end of the year, and we've got a lot of other ideas. So stay tuned. Thank you for downloading the show, and you know, be safe out there. It's starting to get wet.
And so keep sending your cards and letters. Well, it's getting wet, except for the people down in Australia. They're like, finally summer.
Yeah, that's right. You know, that's the life, man. That is the life. Like, they get to watch racing when it's shitty out.
Yeah,
and then they get to go and start writing, and we like lose everything. We like lose our writing time, and we don't have any writing to watch. So,
but dude, Christmas in July would be really weird.
I guess, yeah.
All right, everybody, thank you. Send your cards and letters in. We'd be happy to talk to you, and enjoy the next week. And talk to you soon.
Ciao.
Ciao.